The Church of God, the Eternal, presents the 16th message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, November 8th, 2025.
Well, in the last installment of this series on the books of Samuel, we were introduced finally to young David in 1 Samuel chapter 16. We saw in that chapter that Samuel actually anointed David in the presence of his family, otherwise in secret in the town of Bethlehem where his family lived. And then later, David was called to the king's court to play his harp for Saul in response now to this malady that came over Saul as a response of an evil spirit because of God's removal of his special protection and inspiration because of Saul's rebellion. And so David was summoned to play for him, which actually provided a soothing relief, a temporary band-aid, if you will, to mask the underlying symptoms of Saul's problems. David, therefore, was introduced to the kingly court in the hometown of Saul and had his first exposure to that. Now, and if you think about it, you're talking about the future king because God had hand-selected him, had Samuel anoint him even as a youth, and yet now, by what seemed to be accident or happenstance, and it wasn't, this young lad was now brought to the court of the king and actually spent. And it doesn't tell us how much time he spent there. But he's literally in the king's presence. He becomes a favorite of the king because of the soothing nature of his service with his music. And as we saw, and it's still a conundrum to me, and actually he becomes Saul's armor bearer. Now we're going to get into, I'll repeat chapter 16, verse 18. Just to reconfirm this principle, verse 18 of 1 Samuel 16 says, "Then answered one of the servants and said, Behold, I have seen a son of Jesse the Bethlehemite that is cunning in playing and a mighty valiant man and a man of war." And this is my conundrum because I still can't reconcile how at this stage in the storyline, David has a reputation for being a man of war. There's nothing written indicate what he's done. But anyway, as we go through chapter 17, I'm going to tell you everything I don't understand and everything that confuses me without answer. And I keep trying to find an answer. I keep trying to solve this puzzle. Even last night, I was looking at my notes, and I'm still trying to solve the puzzle of chapter 16, 17, and 18. And I'll already tell you, I can't do it. So all I have are the facts of the story, most important, which God did provide for us to be able to understand and to learn the important lessons from. The other things are not important. They're just things I would like to know. But I'll share that with you as we go. So he said at this time, he's a cunning player, a mighty valiant man, a man of war, and prudent in matters. He already had a reputation for wisdom and a comely person. He was a good-looking young man, and the Eternal is with him. He already had a reputation now of having God's special favor. Now, we know Samuel already laid hands upon him, so nobody else except his own family knew that this anointing took place, and yet, apparently then, immediately, with God's special inspiration and help, David is already manifesting the special fruits that make him stand apart from people around him. So, I'm going to read to you a passage out of the Bible story book from the Worldwide Church Ambassador College, because they had to, you know, draw some conclusions in order to try and for a children's Bible story series and try to tell these stories. Then they had to make some conclusions about these kind of misty or murky details. So I'm going to read this passage to you. This is from volume 6 of the Bible story, page 55 and 56, if any of you want to look those up yourself. But here's what it said concerning this last part of chapter 16. It says, quote, "When the young man was brought to Saul, he saw that Saul was having trouble breathing and looked very uncomfortable as he sat stiffly in his chair. 'Play your harp,' Saul muttered. 'If your music can give me any relief, I need it now.' David began strumming his harp. It was a light, easy-handled instrument fashioned somewhat like a lyre or a lyre. Everyone in the room was pleased with the soothing music of the skillfully fingered strings. After a few minutes, Saul started to relax and stretch out comfortably in his chair. David continued playing for quite a while, carefully confining his performance to the kind music that would restfully be restfully cheerful. Finally, Saul stood up. David assumed that this meant that he should stop playing. 'Your music has caused me to feel much better,' Saul smilingly told David. 'Now I shall be able to sleep. Do whatever you want to do, but be close at hand if I should need you again.' During the next few days, David was sent for several times whenever Saul's miserable malady reoccurred. Happily for Saul, his trouble gradually went away every time David played for him. 'You have been a great help to me,' Saul told David. 'I wish you could stay with me for a long time, but if the Philistines stir up another war, I'll have to leave here and suffer through my ill spells without your music.' 'Why couldn't I join your army and go with you?' David asked. 'My soldiers must be older men who are experienced in battle,' Saul replied. 'You are a fine musician, not a trained fighter.' 'Why couldn't I go along as your armor bearer?' David eagerly inquired. 'If you think I would be afraid when the enemy approaches, I promise to always hand you your armor before I start running.' 'A great idea,' Saul laughed. 'From now on, you're my official armor bearer,'" unquote. All right, so there's a fictionalized fill in the blank to try to make sense of this whole thing. So again, this is part of my quandary of trying to explain it. How does he become so favored by Saul that Saul makes David his armor bearer? And yet, when we get especially to the end of chapter 17 and the first part of chapter 18, it's going to look like Saul never met David before. So those are the unanswered things, and we'll talk about that. By the way, we're going to get into chapter 17 now. Chapter 17 has 58 verses. I promise you, we're not going to cover all of that today. So I'm anticipating and planning to get through chapter 17 in two sermons. So we'll get a start and see how far we get into it. Chapter 17 now, 1 Samuel, verse 1. "Now the Philistines gathered together their armies to battle and were gathered together at Shochoh, which belongeth to Judah." So in other words, the Philistines have made an incursion into the territory of Judah. "And pitched between Shochoh and Azekah in Ephes Damin." And I'm not going to get into every detail. I'm going to give you a short description of where this was geographically. "And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together and pitched by the valley of Elah and set the battle in array against the Philistines." Verse 3, "And the Philistines stood on a mountain on the one side, and Israel stood on a mountain on the other side, and there was a valley between them." Okay, so this gives you the topography mainly to understand is that they both wanted to be on high ground. So the Philistines come in from the west, and they basically camp out on a mountain ridge, or these were considered actually low foothills in this particular area. The location is actually today called Shephelah, which are lowland foothills of ancient Judah, serving as a strategic buffer zone between the Philistine coastal plain to the west and the Judean hill country to the east. This was only a few miles west of Bethlehem, where David lived. So less than 15 miles, literally, probably between David's home and the battlefield, okay, which becomes important as we get into this a little bit. But in essence, you've got, and there's no indication about how many soldiers the Philistines have versus the number of Israelites that Saul took with him. So we don't know. Now, I've seen renderings, and even again, I made reference to like a recent kind of TV or series that actually that talked about the Israelites being outnumbered 2-1 or something. Well, there's nothing in here that says the sizes of the armies. I'm going to assume that they might have been well matched in numbers. Otherwise, there might have been a battle which ensued. And yet, as we're going to find out in the storyline, these armies basically look across the valley at each other for 40 days. So I don't know. I'm just drawing a presumptive conclusion that it may be because neither one of them held a clear advantage. They're both on high ground. Nobody wants to be on the low ground and have to fight uphill. So there's a natural reason why these armies now are facing off across this valley in between them. Okay, now we're going to find out about Goliath. Verse 4, and there went out a champion out of the camp of the Philistines named Goliath of Gath. All right, so the first thing we find out is he is, and you remember the city of Gath because it was one of the five major cities of the Philistines. We covered that way back when we talked about the Ark of the Covenant being taken back in the days of Eli. And then, remember, the Philistines passed the Ark through all these different cities of Gath over a multi-month period of time, and Gath was one of them, where these boils and these curses that God, you know, struck down the people. So this is now a long year hence, a couple of generations later, or at least a couple of generations later, but Gath was one of those major cities. So it says Goliath was from the city of Gath, unlike recent portrayals that want to say that he was a giant in like this giant family hiding in seclusion away from all of the regular humans. They want to portray it as if he's some sort of a demigod, with this, which I'm going to show you, comes right out of Greek mythology. Okay, not fact whatsoever. But people like to portray this, and we'll cover that. But this says very clearly he was from the city of Gath. Okay, so he was a regular old Philistine. The problem was he was just a whole lot bigger than his compatriots, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. I'm going to define at least what the scholars think these measurements were to give us some estimates. But I'll read all the way through verse 7 first. Whose height was 6 cubits and a span, and he had a helmet of brass upon his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of brass. It's going to be important to find out how heavy that was. Verse 6, he had greaves of brass upon his legs and a target of brass between his shoulders. Verse 7, and the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron, and one bearing a shield went before him. Okay. What can we know about these measurements? And I'm just going by what the scholars mainly say about equivalence to our modern day measurements. Standard scholarly approximations say that a cubit was equal to 18 inches. For you that like metric, 45.72 centimeters. And a span was basically half a cubit or 9 inches. Okay, so in essence, what this is saying is that, I'll keep going here and summarize later. A shekel also, because this is a weight, it's used to measure money, called a shekel, but in this case, it's actually a unit of weight, which supposedly equaled 11.4 grams, which is 0.025 pounds. Okay, how do we add all this up? Well, based upon these estimates of the equivalent of a cubit and a span, Goliath's height was 9 feet 9 inches. 9 feet 9 inches. Okay. His coat of mail, which of course was this iron weave. You've seen it in the movies, you know, from medieval times where they wear a coat of mail, which gives them protection, and it moves and all that, but gives them protection against penetrating weapons. This coat of mail weighed approximately 126 pounds. Now think about being a soldier, and this is just one element of your armor, of the things that you're wearing, but the coat of mail that drapes the core of your body weighs 126 pounds. How strong, how big, how strong would you have to be to actually fight in a coat of mail that heavy? What about this spearhead? So he's got this spear, which is like a weaver's beam, meaning it's much longer and more significant than the average spear. This spearhead was they estimate was approximately 15 pounds, just the actual spearhead, 15 pounds or 6.8 kilograms, much heavier than a typical modern spear tip, which scholars estimate would have been 1 to 2 pounds. So a normal soldier carrying a spear that would have a 1 to 2 pound spearhead, and this guy's got a spearhead of 15 pounds, just to give you a comparison. The shaft of it, it says, was like a weaver's beam, which they estimate would have been 1 to 2 inches thick, 6 to 8 feet long, like what we would call a loom rod. Any of you that know anything about, you know, weaving or how the process that's used. But it's a very large instrument, suggesting that this is a massive thrusting weapon. We saw back in verse 6, it said he had a target of brass between his shoulders. What does that mean? Well, I looked it up, and I think all the scholars agree that what this really means from the Hebrew word is actually a brass javelin. So it's not, I first thought it kind of read in English, I would have assumed it's like a breastplate. But no, they say it's actually a brass javelin that he slung on his back. So it was another weapon, a smaller weapon, but likewise could have been anywhere from 15 to 30 pounds. Okay. So this guy's got to be strong to be able to carry all of these armaments. What are we going to say about Goliath in particular, giants in general? Because there's so much false information out there. I just want to address that. First, how does it compare to the tallest people that we know of today or in recent history? If Goliath was 9 feet 9 inches or thereabouts, so let's just say anything over 9 feet, how does that compare to the tallest people that we have today? The tallest man ever recorded was a man named Robert Wadlow, who was 8 feet 11 inches tall. So a little less, so Goliath was only a little less than a foot taller than this guy. Okay, just for comparison. But Robert Wadlow was actually an American. He lived from 1918 to 1940. He was the tallest person ever verified, measured multiple times by doctors, including the day before he died, okay, in 1940. Who was number two, just for instance? I just kind of wrote some of these down because I thought it was kind of interesting. The second tallest human being ever measured or certified was a man named John Rogan. Guess what? He was also an American. He was 8 foot 9 inches, so he was only two inches shorter than the tallest. He was born in 1867 and died in 1905. He was measured while he was bedridden. He was the tallest African-American man ever registered. Number three was a man named John F. Carroll. He was also an American. There's something going on now. Why are these Americans ended up being the tallest in the world? I do not know. John F. Carroll, 8 feet 8 inches. So he's still right up there in striking distance. Number four was a man named Willie Camper, also an American, 1924 to 1943. Oh, did I tell you John F. Carroll was born in 1932 and died in 1969? Willie Camper was 8 feet 7 inches, died in 1943. He was a circus performer. His height was confirmed from historical photos and records. Go down the list. Number 10 on the list is the tallest man who's alive right now as of 2025. And his name is, he's not an American, he's actually Turkish. His name is Sultan Kosun. He's 8 feet 3 inches. He was born in 1982 and he's still alive right now. He was measured by the Guinness Book of World Records in 2011. No one taller has been verified since today, 8 feet 3 inches. So this tells you, okay, less than 9 feet, but in the 8 foot, upper end as far as tallest measure. The tallest human I think I ever saw was an NBA basketball player named Manute Bol. And I remember him being incredibly tall. I had to look it up to see how tall he was. He was 7'7", which actually tied for the tallest professional basketball player on record, which I didn't know that at the time. He was of African origin. I saw him, my family lived in San Antonio, and I used to periodically get some tickets to NBA games to watch the San Antonio Spurs. And I think at this time, he like played for five different teams, and I think he was playing for the Golden State Warriors. I think I saw that. But this guy, 7'7", I mean, is absolutely huge. The thing was, you know how much he weighed? He only weighed 200 pounds. So tell me what you think a 7'7" guy who weighs 200 pounds would look like. He looked like a stick. He looked like he had spindly legs, and he wasn't that coordinated. He would kind of run down the court, and he wasn't a great shot. Do you know what he was famous for? Blocking shots. He basically just stood around there and could. He had like an 8'6" wingspan. And this is a guy that's 7'7". They've got one, by the way, I just saw an article this past week, the tallest collegiate basketball player right now in the USA has set a record, and he's 7'9". So if he ends up going pro, he will take over as the tallest NBA basketball player. We'll see, but 7'9" tall. So we're talking about really tall guys. But to give you a comparison, then think what another foot taller than these guys are. That's in essence what Goliath appeared likely to have been. Is that so outrageous that we're having to talk about a mythical being? No. This is what the world says. I'm going to give you just a quick summary of this. What I'm going to call the heresy of the giants. The idea goes that Goliath was of the Nephilim. The giants, that's the word in the Hebrew translated back in Genesis 6, verse 4, that these people say were actually children of the mixture between angels and human women. An absolute lie, and it is a heresy. Turn with me quickly to Genesis 6, verse 4. It says, there were giants in the earth in those days, Nephilim. And also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men which were of old, men of renown. So what is taken out of context is this reference to the sons of God. And you guys know this, and we've covered it, and I'm not going to dwell on it. We're not talking about angels. Yes, in a number of places in the Bible, God calls the angels sons of God, but he also calls human beings sons of God. Okay? So which is it? Well, context will tell you. Again, if you understand the answer in the back of the book, God created every creature to reproduce after its own kind. Okay? Goats produce goats, and bears produce bears, and lions produce lions, and cows produce cows, and human beings produce human beings. There's no such thing as a compatibility for procreation between an angel and a human being. So it's all mythology. This idea that these giants of old were half angel, half human, it's absolutely a lie, and it's sponsored by the enemy, Satan the devil, by the way. Because Satan, again, wants to try to take on attributes that God never gave him, like the ability to procreate. Angels were never given the ability to procreate. So the fact that human beings believe that angels could procreate is a part of the lie. As proof, Matthew 22:29. Here Jesus Christ said it from his own mouth. Because this in the midst of a debate, one of those many debates with the Jews of the day, who were apostates, who had embraced all kinds of false doctrine, which is why Christ criticized them as being hypocrites. Here in Matthew 22:29, Jesus answered and said to them, you do err, not knowing the scriptures, nor the power of God. You don't understand about the way God did what he did. They were arguing about the sects of the Jews that did not believe in the resurrection of the dead. And so they're trying to trap him by saying, okay, a woman theoretically has had seven husbands. She marries one and then he dies, then she marries another one and he dies. So consecutively, she has seven husbands. In the resurrection, whose wife is she going to be? As if that's supposed to trip up Jesus. And his answer was, you do err, not knowing the scriptures, nor the power of God. Verse 30, for in the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are as the angels of God in heaven. Meaning what? They're without sex. There is no male or female, either in the God family, let alone in the family of angels. God did not create the angelic host to be male or female. So could they procreate? No. They're celibate by the very form that God gave them. There's no such thing as angels being able to produce. They can't create. One of the big lies is that Satan can create like God can. So people want to say, oh, the dinosaurs, they're so evil and, you know, ugly and whatever. Surely God didn't create them. Maybe Satan created the dinosaurs. No, he didn't. Satan can't create anything. He has no power to create, and he has no power to procreate. So this whole idea that angels, you know, cohabited with women and produce these superhumans, it's not godly at all. So that is not an answer for the Nephilim of Genesis, and it's certainly not an answer for the giants in the days of the Israelites. Where did some of this come from? Well, a lot of it ended up surfacing in literature that can be documented in the Second Temple era of Judaism, let's say from 300 to 100 BC, in this book called the Book of Enoch. And if any of you have toyed or thought about, well, I wonder if the Book of Enoch is like legitimate, like the books in the Bible, but why isn't Enoch in the Bible? Because it's not. It's not inspired by God. It's actually written by apostates. Okay? But this is, and this is an example. You want to prove that it's not legitimate? Because the Book of Enoch basically supports this idea about angels cohabiting with women and producing supergiants, which tells you it's fake. But this was a Jewish book. But how far back did it go? Not beyond 300 BC. So relatively early days in that period of darkness between the days that are documented in the Bible and the days of Ezra and Nehemiah, the second temple when it was rebuilt after they came, the Jews came back out of Babylonian captivity. God allowed them by a miracle to rebuild the city of Jerusalem and the temple. But then you've got this dark period of a couple hundred years between the days of Jesus Christ when there's virtually no documentation. But out of it comes the Pharisees. All of a sudden, the Pharisees end up in the days of Jesus, but there's no real history of where the Pharisees came from. So there was this dark period, and out of it came all these writings, which were spurious. They weren't inspired by God at all. They were lies. So they claim, this Book of Enoch claims that the Nephilim were hybrids of angels and humans. And that via this demonic influence of these genetic remnants, they set the stage for a post-flood giants like the Anakim and the Rephaim, equated with the Nephilim in Enoch and the Jubilees, another one of the books of Josephus, by the way. So this Book of Enoch is spurious just by that. You know it's a lie. This Book of Enoch said it originated as a composite work with its earliest sections, including the Book of the Watchers, composed in Aramaic or Hebrew during the 3rd to 2nd centuries BC, amid Hellenistic influence. What does that mean? The Greeks? Who were these Jews who wrote this Book of Enoch, and where did they get their inspiration? From the Greeks. And what were the Greeks famous for? Greek mythology. Who were the ones that sponsored this idea of this cohabitation between gods and humans? The Greeks. So that's likely where all of this came from. Okay, and Christ, just keep in mind, Christ called them all, you know, hypocrites and vipers. Then even Josephus. So, you know, we put a certain amount of stock in the writings of Josephus, and he lived a long time after Jesus, but wrote concerning and gave and tried to fill in a number of pieces of information. But Josephus isn't totally trustworthy either. And guess what? Josephus is one that bought into this lie. He said in the Antiquity of the Jews, the angels lusted after women, producing giants whose spirits caused ongoing evil. Josephus called them the, quote, angels of God, unquote, who, quote, yielded to the appetites of the flesh, unquote. Angels can't yield to the appetites of the flesh. They don't have the parts for it. Okay? So just to put in context, if anybody, if you read or pick up some of this stuff and say, oh, I wonder about this or wonder about that, understand the lies of Satan, which are intended literally to distract us away from the simple truth of what God did and the limits that he put upon all of these classes of beings. That if you understand nothing more than the fact that God created every creature to reproduce after its own kind, you've got the answer. Creatures only reproduce with creatures of like kind. It's a law of nature, and it will not, and it never has been broken. Okay, so what does that have to do with Goliath? Back to 1 Samuel 17. So we've got this giant. He's over 9 feet tall, closer to 10 feet maybe. The other conclusion I draw is he can't be a Manute Bol type character who's 9 feet tall and weighs 200 or even 250 pounds. Otherwise, he would be weak physically for his physical size and structure. If you had somebody that tall, but they don't have the girth and the substance of muscle and bone literally to be able to support it, how's he going to wear a coat of mail that's 126 pounds, let alone carry, you know, with the helmet and the greaves on his legs, a 30-pound potential javelin on his back? How's he going to carry all of this and be able to be any kind of a warrior at all? So he has to be proportionate for his height, which would be the unusual thing. Not just super tall and skinny as a rail. He's got to be substantial for his height. There's got to be some proportionality in order for him to be that much of a imposing figure. All right. Back to chapter 17 of 1 Samuel, verse 8. So here comes Goliath out of the army of the Philistines, and he stood and cried unto the armies of Israel and said unto them, why are you come out to set your battle in array? So again, these armies are on opposite hills, looking across a valley. Goliath marches out and now is taunting and mocking the Israelite army. I don't know how close he got to them. He went at least halfway. Did he go more than that? I don't know. Says he came out with his armor bearer. He stood and cried unto the armies of Israel and said unto them, why are you come out to set your battle in array? Am not I a Philistine, and you servants of Saul? Choose you a man for you and let him come down to me. Confusing, and I still don't know exactly what was the modern version of what Goliath was really saying in this taunt. It's translated here in the Old King James. It says, why are you come out to set your battle in array? Am not I a Philistine? The sense I get from it, and it's not supported necessarily by the Hebrew and all this the stuff, but I'm trying to look at the big picture. And what makes sense to me that he's really saying is, why have you brought out this whole army to face me? I'm only one Philistine. I'm only one single Philistine. As if he's denigrating his own height. He's acting like he's not even admitting to being as huge as he is. And he walks out there, all he's got is an armor bearer, being a man who's carrying his shield. And the question I don't know about this is whether this is a shield bearer who literally held the shield during battle, or whether he was just carrying it until he handed it to him. I didn't take the time to look that up, or what the scholars think they know. Or don't know, but he walks out with just this shield bearer. And in my mind, I see him saying, Why have you arrayed this whole line in front of me, Israelites? I'm only one Philistine. Choose you a man for you and let him come down to me. Verse 9, if he be able to fight with me and to kill me, then will we be your servants. So here's this pact. In essence, he's offering the Israelites this deal. Instead of our armies clashing with great death on both sides, let's just settle this with a battle one-on-one to the death. I'll fight anybody you send out to be your champion. And if you win, we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then shall you be our servants and serve us. You'll voluntarily make yourselves our slaves if I win. But if you beat me, if your guy, if your champion beats me, all of us as Philistines in this army voluntarily give up our sovereignty and will be your slaves. Verse 10, and the Philistine said, I defy the armies of Israel this day. I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. What was the reaction from the Israelites and Saul in particular? When Saul and all Israel heard those words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. A big part of the whole strategy with these ancient armies was psychological. And very often, and there's a lot of documented battles in history if you've studied in any of it, including much that's in the Bible, that tells you the side with the psychological advantage could very often prevail even if they were underdogs. And so here is the psychological taunt that's going out, and it works. The Israelites, including their king, is actually terrified by the presence of this huge man standing before them, taunting them. They were dismayed and greatly afraid. All right, what happens next? All right, now verse 12. It's almost like a new little sub-chapter or a tangent goes on here. And this is part of that conundrum for me. Because now we get, in essence, a repeat or a retelling of the history of the pedigree of David. We already had that in chapter 16, but now we get another one. Verse 12. Now, David was the son of the Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse, and he had eight sons. And the man went among men for an old man in the days of Saul. So he had eight sons and several daughters as well, who aren't, only two of them are also named. But if David's the youngest of the sons, number eight, yeah, his father was pretty old. And this says he was actually considered a very old man in their town of Bethlehem. Okay, so we've already had this, some details. This gives us a few details we didn't have from chapter 16. First, why is he called an Ephrathite? Well, Ephrath, E-P-H-R-A-T-H, was actually the pre-Israelite Canaanite name for the city that became what the Israelites called Bethlehem. So that's what it was. It was the ancient name of the Canaanites for it. And that region of Bethlehem in the tribe of Judah. All right, verse 13. And the three eldest sons of Jesse, we were already introduced to them in chapter 16, when Samuel came to anoint one of the sons. So we kind of had this, but here it's repeated. The three eldest sons of Jesse went and followed Saul to battle. So here we find out that the three oldest of his eight sons are actually soldiers in Saul's army right here. And the names of his three sons that went to battle were Eliab, the firstborn, the next unto him, Abinadab, and the third, Shammah. And we've had that information from last chapter. Verse 14, and David was the youngest, and the three eldest followed Saul. So David didn't, being the youngest, he didn't go to war. If you turn over to 1 Chronicles 2, verse 12 through 15, you have another parallel family tree concerning David's family here, with a seeming contradiction, which is a good time for us to answer that. First Chronicles 2, verse 12 says, "And Boaz beget Obed, and Obed beget Jesse." There's David's father's grandfather and great-grandfather. Boaz was the one, if you remember, who married Ruth, who was a Moabitess. Okay, so that's, you got a whole book dedicated to her story. Boaz beget Obed, Obed beget Jesse, and Jesse beget his firstborn, Eliab, and Abinadab the second, and Shema the third. And now we get in verse 14 information we don't have in 1 Samuel. Nathanael the fourth, Radai the fifth, Ozem the sixth, and David the seventh. Oh, wait a minute. I thought we just read that David was the eighth son. Here in 1 Chronicles 2, it says David was the seventh son. What do we say about that? Can we reconcile it? Or maybe this wasn't inspired by God? Okay, here's the simple answer to it. When were the books of the Chronicles written? Several hundred years after. Okay, the events. After the Jews came back out of 70 years of Babylonian captivity, same period I mentioned before during Ezra and Nehemiah when God allowed them to re-inhabit the promised land, rebuild the city of Jerusalem and the temple, then the Chronicles were written, inspired by God, for what purpose? To reconfirm the family trees from hundreds of years back to prove who were legitimate descendants now to be able to inhabit the family properties of old. Okay? And do you think that was simple to do? Oh, no. And were there debates about it? Yeah, just read Ezra and Nehemiah. And there were a whole lot of people who were claiming to be Israelites who were not Israelites. So the books of Chronicle were inspired by God as a means to show who were legitimate modern day at the time descendants of these tribes with the right to take possession of their family inheritance property. So we have a contradiction. Chronicle said David was the seventh son. 1 Samuel says he was the eighth son. What's a legitimate explanation for that? Chronicles is focusing on the particular descendants of these Israelite families who lived to have children and passed down. What likely happened was that one of those sons of Jesse did not live. And it doesn't tell us which one died, maybe even in battle. One of the ones who are not named. Okay, so that's a legitimate explanation for it. If there was one son who died young and never had children, then he didn't even make the list in Chronicles. Because the Chronicles list was all about finding who begat who, to find out who these rightful heirs were after the Babylonian captivity. Okay, whereas 1 Samuel is literally speaking about the family, which calls him in two different places the eighth son. Okay, so that's my explanation for that, which is supported by a number of scholars. All right, back to 1 Samuel 17, verse 15 now. So we find that the oldest three of Jesse's sons is actually in the army of Saul. The others, including David, are not. Verse 15, but David went and returned from Saul. This is one of those texts that throws my whole... I would love to fix all of my worries and uncertainties about the timeline. And if verse 15 weren't there, it would be easier to do. But verse 15 is here, so we have to deal with it. David went and returned from Saul. Okay. This is referring back to chapter 16 when he was called up to play the harp for Saul. And it doesn't tell us how long he was in Saul's court. And it doesn't tell us why he left and went home. Because we read last time in chapter 16 that David was so beloved and so valued by Saul that he sent a message to Jesse and asked him to be a permanent member of the court. But then we find that David didn't stay in the court. So he was asked to be a part of the permanent court, but all of a sudden he's back home with the sheep again. And the question is, okay, how did that happen? David went and returned from Saul, ostensibly from playing his harp for Saul in his court, to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. Why? Nobody knows. We can make up all kinds of stories. I'm good at that too. Is it because David stayed with Saul in his home base until this threat of the Philistines? But as soon as Saul and the armies went to the battlefield, David went home. Okay, that's the most reasonable one I can think of if you want to guess and fill in the storyline. Whatever we find here, it says he returned from being with Saul and he went home and he's back with the sheep again. Verse 16, and the Philistine, meaning Goliath, drew near morning and even. How often? Was it just one time? No. The Philistine drew near morning and evening and presented himself 40 days. So here's this standoff between these two armies on the hills looking across the valley at each other. Every day in the morning and in the evening, Goliath walks out with his shield bearer and taunts Israel, challenging them to come up with a champion who will come out and face him in hand-to-hand combat. 40 days, twice a day, this has been going on. And finally, now verse 17, we find David's going to be sent to the battlefield. Jesse said, verse 17, unto David his son, take now for thy brethren an ephah of this parched corn and these 10 loaves and run to the camp to thy brethren. Again, he was only, I didn't verify it for sure, but I saw some sources that say he might have been 6 miles from the battlefield. Others have said 15 miles. Wherever the distance between Bethlehem and this standoff. But in essence, his father said, run to the camp. Verse 18, and carry these 10 cheeses unto the captain of their thousand, and look how thy brethren fare and take their pledge. All right, what do we know from this? One, this pledge doesn't mean ask for a promise. You think a pledge is like a guarantee of some kind. No, this is actually a word that means to get the report from his eldest sons about how they're doing. He basically wants a report on how they're faring, about their well-being. So remember, by this time, the armies have been out there for almost 40 days. Now, and it doesn't tell us again how many soldiers are in each line. Where are they getting their food and their supplies? Supplies run out. The Philistines now aren't at home, which means they're likely sending out raiding parties to get as much food as they can. The Israelites, they're in their home territory, but they're having to feed this army. They've already been out there for 40 days, or nearly 40 days at this point. All right, so David's father sends David basically to send supplies for the three sons who are in the army. But remember, it also said, and carry these 10 cheeses unto the captain of their thousand. So it wasn't, I get the sense it's like, don't just take food to your three brothers, but show respect for the chain of command and the commander of the unit that they're in and take him food as well. I don't know if that's accurate or not, but that's the sense that I get from reading it. So verse 19. Now Saul and they all, the men of Israel, were in the valley of Elah, fighting with the Philistines. And again, if you read this whole thing in context, it doesn't look like there was ever an actual clash between the armies. They were lined up as if to fight, ready to fight, posturing to fight, but not actually engaging in battle. Verse 20, and David rose up early in the morning and left the sheep with a keeper, and took and went as Jesse had commanded him. And that's very important in the storyline you're going to find out. David didn't do this of his own accord. He wasn't just wanting to sneak off to see what was going on. His father specifically sent him with this mission. And he came to the trench, meaning the site of the battle, as the host was going forth to the fight. But they did this every morning. They all marched out to their battle lines, probably rattling, you know, their swords and their spears, basically posturing. But no battle happens. And shouted for the battle. For Israel and the Philistines had put the battle in array. This gives you when it says fighting with the Philistines, this clarifies it. They were lining up against each other, but they actually weren't clashing. Army against army. So I'm calling that posturing. And the scholars seem to agree with that. Verse 22, and David left his carriage in the hand of the keeper of the carriage. What is this? So you give immediate idea in your mind because you think you know what a carriage is, and I do too, you know, like Cinderella's carriage or something like that. No, this isn't talking about a carriage or a wagon that people ride in. This is a word that translates back from the Hebrew basically as baggage, supplies, or equipment. It's not a wheeled vehicle. This carriage is basically the supplies he was carrying. It was all the supplies his father told him to take, the food, especially for his brothers and his unit, and the brother's unit. Baggage, supplies, and equipment. So he turned over all the supplies that he brought to the keeper of the carriage, the keeper of the supplies. In modern day, we would call this in a naval ship, he was called the purser. The particular officer under the captain who was in charge of all the supplies on board and kept inventory of how much food they had and everything else. In the armies, typically this person who took care of all the supplies was called either a commissary or a quartermaster. So you've heard those terms, all right? So we would say in more modern wording that David took all of his supplies and handed it over to the quartermaster and ran into the army and came and saluted his brethren. He found wherever his brothers were camped or whether now in the morning they're arrayed. Now, I don't know it's the morning, except that's the other question I have. Sideline, but again, it says David left early in the morning. My question is, because he's now going to witness Goliath taunting the Israelites, is this one of the morning taunts or the evening taunts? And the Bible doesn't choose to tell us. So again, it could be either one. Depends on how long it took David to get there. But he shows up, turns over all these supplies to the quartermaster, and then runs into the army, finds his brother. And now, as we're getting ready to read, Goliath shows up. Is this a morning showing up of Goliath or an evening showing up of Goliath? We don't know. I'm going to draw some speculations just for the sake of the story, but we'll get to that. He ran into the army and came and saluted his brethren. And as he talked with them, behold, there came up the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, out of the armies of the Philistines and spake according to the same words, the taunt. Look at your great army of Saul. I'm just one Philistine. Send out your champion and let's fight one-on-one. David heard them. 40 days this has been going on. David hears it for the first time. So I like the idea that this was the morning approach of Goliath. Only because you know, we already know the story. I'm not like spoiling the story, right? Because you know David kills Goliath and then the armies of Israel run through. How long is it going to take? Because when they rout the Philistines and the Philistines run and they chase them all the way to their city gates. If this was in the evening, all this would be taking place at night or after, or likely sunset or after sunset into the dark. Maybe so. The Bible doesn't say one way or the other. I think it makes more sense that this was a morning taunting. I don't know. But on the other hand, this was the evening taunting, and then maybe David was overnight before he actually went out and confronted Goliath in the morning. So I can argue this either way. We just don't know. Nevertheless, David hears the taunt. Verse 24, and all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were sore afraid. And they've been doing this for 40 days. They line up like they're big and tough or whatever, and as soon as Goliath come out, they all fade away. And the men of Israel said, have you seen? So they're talking to David. David's the newcomer. He's like the only one that hasn't been around. He's a youth. But people like to tell stuff to the new guy who hasn't been there to see it. All the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man that has come up? Surely to defy Israel he has come up, and it shall be." And here's the important part to them. "The man who kills him, the king will enrich him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel." There's a reward that Saul has offered to any Israelite in his army that is willing to go out and confront Goliath. He's given an incentive. Saul has promised to reward an Israelite champion with wealth, a wife of one of his daughters, and what does it mean, make his father's house free in Israel? Freedom from taxes. So, and remember all the way back to 1 Samuel chapter 8, when Israel first asked for a king, and Samuel, by God's instruction, told him what's going to happen. You're going to be sorry for your king because all the things the king's going to do, he's going to take your boys for soldiers, and he's going to tax you. And he's going to give the wealth that he gets off the backs of your families, and he's going to give it to his favorites. So this was going on. Saul was already doing this 20, 25 years into his kingship. This has come to pass. So one of the rewards that Saul was offering was to make the family of an Israelite champion free from taxation, which probably was a big deal, let alone becoming the husband of one of the princesses and great wealth. How did David respond? Verse 26, "And David spake to the men that stood by him, saying, What shall be done to the man that killeth the Philistine and taketh away the reproach from Israel?" David, did you not just hear us tell you? This is another question I have. It's like, okay, the soldiers just told him. Saul is going to give an Israelite champion wealth, a wife, and freedom from taxation. And then David turns around and like asks like he didn't hear it. What's the answer? "What shall be done to the man that kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" And the people answered him after this manner, saying, "So shall it be done to the man that killeth him," meaning just what we told you already is the answer to your question, David. All right, how do we make sense of this? What is more likely happened? Didn't the soldiers just answer David's question, and then he made them answer it again or confirm it? The best explanation I have is an orientation between what the soldiers were focused upon versus what David was focused upon. The soldiers, in their explanation, referred to Goliath as a man. David refers to him as an uncircumcised Philistine. The soldiers emphasized in their explanation that Goliath is defying the armies of Israel. But David, when he asks for confirmation, he emphasizes that they are the armies of God. Do you see the difference? The soldiers are thinking physical, and they're thinking about the reward to the man who beats the giant. They're thinking, they don't seem to have God in their thinking whatsoever. It's about Goliath the man, and it's about the armies of Israel, human beings. David also emphasizes, besides that they're the armies of God, the soldiers focus upon personal gain for the champion. David emphasizes, what does he consider the real reward that's valuable to fight for? He didn't talk about the physical riches or the wealth that Saul was willing to give. He's asking about who can take away the reproach from Israel. Do you see the difference in orientation? David cares about removing the reproach from the nation of Israel as the people of God. He's not focusing on a physical reward for himself personally. So David seems to be asking, after he heard the soldiers recite what Saul was willing to give to a champion of the mammon, wealth, a wife, and freedom from taxation, David is really asking, what reward will God give to the champion? not Saul the king. Because David absolutely is looking to God involved in this scenario, which the others are not. That takes us to a good stopping point. When we continue next time in verse 28, we're going to see first the response of David's oldest brother Eliab, which is very instructive in itself. David then being taken into an audience with King Saul, and then the battle that ensues. Hopefully in the next installment, we will actually complete chapter 17 and the battle of David and Goliath.
The Church of God, the Eternal, has just presented the 16th message in a series by Mr. John Brisby, entitled A Survey of the Books of Samuel, given in Eugene, Oregon, November 8th, 2025.